Welcome to the Barnes Review History Hour. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Monday, July 17th, 2023. The Barnes Review History Hour is a program featuring contributors to the Barnes Review History Magazine, a bi-monthly print and digital publication dedicated to bringing history into accord with the facts, as well as other special guests. Please do consider subscribing to the magazine if you are not already. Check out barnesreview.org for all the details. And today I am joined by Patrick Martin, the co-editor and contributor to the recently published book titled The Honorable Cause, A Free South, which is currently available from the Barnes Review. All right, Patrick Martin, welcome to the program, sir. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much for asking.
Yeah, I'm doing just fine. It's kind of rainy, cloudy day today, unfortunately. But aside from that, I'm doing just fine. I want to start off by thanking you very much for taking the time to speak with me today. You are the co-editor and a contributor to the recently published book titled The Honorable Cause, A Free South, which is currently available from the Barnes Review. I picked up a copy of the book when it was first released. What was that now? 3-4 months ago, something like that?
Yeah, that's right. It was just before April 1st, April being Confederate History Month. And we released it maybe about a week earlier just to kind of do a soft launch.
Okay, yeah, very good. I remember when it first came out and I picked up a copy right away. I literally could not put the book down once I started reading it. It's just very well written, you know, 12 different contributing authors, including James Edwards, who runs the Political Cesspool, a weekly radio program that I pretty much listen to every week. You've also got Neil Kumar, a contributor, and he also – did he run for Senate, was it, or was it House of Representatives? I can't remember.
Yeah, I think he actually ran for both, but I believe it was – I think it was House of Representatives he was running for, his okay. district.
Yeah, so he's a contributor. Also, Dr. Michael Hill, yourself, and many others. And Dr. Michael Hill is the longtime leader of the League of the South, which is one of the – leading Southern nationalist organizations. And the book itself makes a very strong case for the Southern nationalist cause. It's a very interesting read. And I wrote a sort of like a promo type article slash review of the book that was just published in the most recent issue of the Barnes Review magazine. That is the July-August 2023 issue. And that should have arrived to all subscribers by now. I know I received my copy at the very beginning of July. And you can actually read that review at barnesreview.org. It's published on the website. And it's also published as well on my personal website, therealistreport.com. And while you're at thebarnesreview.org, consider subscribing to the magazine if you are not already. It really is the one of the last print revisionist publications in existence. So help us out. Get a subscription. It's a fantastic magazine. It's published bi-monthly, and this most recent issue is excellent. And like I said, it features this article that I wrote sort of promoting and reviewing the book. So with all that being said, to get started, can you please just tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and your experience in the Southern nationalist movement?
Sure. So I'm pretty much what you would consider a middle-class, middle-aged white guy. I come from a professional background. Now I own companies that operate on two continents, one in the country of Georgia and one in three companies here in the United States, all involved in supply chain, which is what I've been doing for the past roughly 20 years. Logistics and supply chain work that I did in the past was primarily on behalf of the U.S. government, not as an employee of the government, although I was at one time, but in a contracting role. So I moved all kinds of goods around the world. I've worked in 78 countries. I have a master's in Islamic studies as well as an MBA. And I did quite well for myself. In about 2015, I was sort of on a constitutional conservative side of things, you know, maybe a little bit to the right, a little bit more to the right, somewhat of a racial realist, but not somebody who would say he was more openly, was the word I would use, hostile towards racial negotiations or however you want to call it, or good relations, I should say. But around 2015, the Dillon Roof incident occurred. And while that was happening, I noticed that all of a sudden, almost like a light switch had gone off, Confederate monuments and history began being torn down throughout the country at a pace that was just astounding. And it didn't just come from the political left, which I always suspected would lead that, but even members of the so-called political right, Republican Party, which stayed silent while monuments to the Southern people who overwhelmingly vote for the Republican Party, the Republican Party just sat there silent and just watched these statues and monuments to our ancestors get torn down. Now, I was raised in Ocala, Florida, but I was raised by an Irish immigrant family, came over in 1940. They never had any skin in the game, so to speak, as pertaining to the North-South divide. And I would actually say I had more of an Irish background upbringing than I would say I had a Southern one. But I definitely had a great deal of Southern friends. My wife is Southern. My children are Southern. They're raised Southern. And so watching these monuments getting torn down really infuriated me. And I just started posting stuff, you know, about how silly this was. And I've always been a history buff as well. And I knew what the arguments were regarding how the war between the states had begun. And so that began a series of arguments. And of course, you argue with leftists, it doesn't go anywhere. But that was back in the wild heyday of 2015 when Facebook had almost no controls, nor did Twitter. And I started a small blog at the time called Bacon Books and Bullets. And really, it was just based on three items that I felt would eventually be banned in these United States. But also was kind of a wink and a nod to Bacon, Nathaniel Bacon, the rebel leader of the late 17th century, Virginian. The American side of me has some Virginian roots to go back to the 1600s. And so, I mean, again, it was sort of an accidental trip into Southern nationalism. I found myself all of a sudden defending the South in 2015 in ways I'd never really thought I'd have to do my entire life. I mean, I was a former Marine. Active duty Marine, that is, you know, once Marine, always a Marine. I had worked, again, on behalf of the government. I had worked for the government both inside the U.S. government and outside of the U.S. government in a contracting role. Many of my clients were U.S. government officials and different agencies and so forth around the world during the global war on terror. And here I was all of a sudden finding myself, you know, along with many others, defending the South. And then, you know, as things continued to progress, it didn't seem there was any let up. In fact, the pedal got pushed to the metal, so to speak. And now monuments are right down the road from my childhood home, such as Gainesville, Florida. I was beginning to tear down monuments like the old Joe statue in the middle of Gainesville. And so I was getting fed up. And I joined the League of the South at the end of 2015, not really knowing much about League of the South. In fact, I learned about them from the SPLC hate site. I looked at the map.
Quite an objective source there.
Right. I mean, I didn't know anything about these groups. And, you know, I looked up. I was like, you know, I'm going to see if I can find a group that's, you know, fighting back, you know, on behalf of the South. And sure enough, League of the South was listed as a hate group because it was pro-Southern. And I looked at their website at the time. And their website was really a cluster. It was all over the place. But it was mostly libertarian type stuff, which I agreed with a lot of it. Anti-Fed, reserve kind of things. And so I joined. I sent my application in, $100, something like that. And I joined League of South. And that was it. I never heard back from League of South. I mean, I think I got a message saying, thank you for becoming a member. And that was it. But come 2017, in 2016, I went to Amaran and met a few members of League of South. 2017, I went to the LS National Conference, got to meet more folks. And I had just relocated from Virginia back to Florida for the first time. It was the first time I was living in Florida in 31 years. And when I was there, I met the Florida League, and they were very active, one of the most active groups within the movement as a whole. And they said, hey, we're going to go to Charlottesville. And I said, sure, let's go to Charlottesville and defend the Lee Monument. Somebody's got to defend the Lee Monument. Well, Charlottesville became an outright disaster, as we all know. I wound up writing a book about it called A Walk in the Park, my Charlottesville story, about what kind of led me to that fateful day at UTR, Unite the Right. And I was doxxed by family members, lost my job. And then after that, you know, struggled a little bit. Finally got, thanks to some MBA alumni, I was able to get back on my feet financially somewhat quickly. Thankfully, I'd gone to a good school with really good guys who knew. In fact, the night before the Unite the Right rally, I was having a steak supper with them at Morton's of Chicago Steakhouse in Richmond, Virginia. And we were talking. They were very supportive of trying to defend Lee Monument. And they knew why I had been up there. They knew why I was at Charlottesville. So they got me a job. And then shortly after that, I wound up getting a message that I was under investigation by the federal government that related to my activities in Afghanistan. But it was coming out of the same district as that which had Charlottesville was involved. So I knew
the
it was
same,
more
the same federal district as Charlottesville.
Yeah, that's right. The Western District of Virginia. So the I had been arrested at Charlottesville, but not during the rally. I was arrested after the fact for having a concealed weapon. Now, when I was in Virginia, I had a concealed carry permit, but I had moved to Florida. I was waiting for Florida to grant me the concealed carry permit. There's some level of reciprocity between the states. In this particular case, Virginia viewed it as once I left Virginia, my concealed carry permit was negated. And so as a Florida resident, I had to have a Florida concealed carry permit in order to conceal, have a concealed weapon. And so they wound up arresting me hours after the event, by the way. I was trying to break into my dadgum car. I locked the freaking – I locked my wife's purse in there. So I was like, oh, you got to be kidding me. So anyway, I wound up in the trunk, that is, and I was trying to – I had the keys to the dadgum car. It was a big old cluster, a big story behind that. But anyway, they arrested me. They gave me a $500 fine and let me go on my way. The judge realized that, you know, I did have a concealed carry permit. Yeah, I did have a legal one in Florida as well. So they gave me a misdemeanor, slap on the wrist. Don't carry in the state of Virginia again without your concealed carry permit on you. But then that district decided to go and investigate me even further. And they found that in 2014, now this is 2019, that they decided to reach out to me. In 2014, I had taken steps to save 36 of my men. It was a contract issue. It was actually September 2013, but 2014 was the fiscal year. And so it was fiscal year 2014 for the U.S. government, that is, that I wound up doing a procedural step that I shouldn't have done, but to get my boys back on base. They were being kicked off of base due to a hiccup in a contract. And 36 unarmed men, white men, being kicked off in the middle of Afghanistan, in the middle of a war zone, is not really, I couldn't abide by that. So I wound up, sending over some paperwork to indicate that they had the right to be on the base. It shouldn't have done it. They did not have the right to be on that base. It wound up being resolved 2 weeks later. The U.S. government wound up issuing the right credentials and none the wiser. Nobody ever gave us a hard time. Well, they found out that I had done this, I'd taken this procedural step, and they were going to charge me with fraud, specifically 36 violations of what was the term they used. It was fraudulent statements to the government, is what they're going to say. The U.S. Department of Defense did not cooperate with the U.S. Department of Justice. Nobody was saying anything. I had a number of senior level military officials who wrote letters of recommendation and praised my work on the ground. Praise the work of my teams on the ground in Afghanistan. They recognized the fact that it was a procedural hiccup, that it had been resolved 2 weeks later, but the DOJ was going to come after me anyway. And then they stated that my wife, who was my business partner at the time, that if my wife was as a business partner, she would be a criminal co-conspirator and they would arrest her as well. And so as
well. Wow. Now, real quick, just to clarify, I hate to interrupt you, but.
Yep.
This is all stemming from paperwork that you submitted to basically keep some of your – I don't know if they're directly your employees or people that you were working with from being abandoned, like, in the middle of Afghanistan?
Yep.
Jeez.
Yep.
This was clearly, like, a politically motivated, you know, persecution of you.
I mean,
this was after – it was known that you attended Charlottesville and had sort of, you know, pro-Southern, pro-white even views, right?
Yep, 100%. They were my employees, you know, and I would fly into Afghanistan fairly frequently. And what the issue was specifically was called a letter of authorization, LOA. And the LOAs expired at the end of the federal fiscal year, and that would be September 30th, 2013. The new LOAs had come in, so prior to that, all of the LOAs had all the stuff that was needed in order to operate. They had housing, food, all the good stuff, medical and what have you, that would be provided to any other military person or contractor working on those bases. For some reason, the new LOAs coming in on October 1st, 2013, had nothing, had no life support whatsoever available to them. and base security being what it is, wound up coming over to them. They had living quarters. They were told that they were going to have to vacate the living quarters because their life support had been withdrawn and they would have to leave the base. Well, by doing so, they would have been stranded. Some of them would have been stranded in really bad areas out, you know, near the Pakistani border. And we were doing secure supply chain at the time. In fact, at that point, we had saved the U.S. government about $330 million of stolen cargo. I had had six men blown up earlier that same year in 2013. We were all over the bases, all over the country, ensuring that U.S. military cargo wasn't being stolen. I'd even gone into Pakistan to reclaim armored vehicles that had been attacked and stolen from a U.S. military convoy before. So I worked my literal ass off, you know, so to speak, for the U.S. government and sort of my men. And they put themselves in harm's way. We were all former military. Some of us had, again, we worked for the U.S. government as well. And we did all of that. And that little paperwork, I wound up checking off some boxes and sending it back over to them and saying, guys, just stay on base. We'll get this sorted in a couple weeks. And sure enough, it did. The folks that were the contracting officers that were based outside of St. Louis, they wound up sending us new LOAs and we were fine. And nobody said anything. Well, again, in 2019, not only did they consider this to be fraudulent, but they also stated that because I used electronic means, it was some kind of conspiracy. They had all kinds of stuff they were going to launch on me. In fact, to the point where they were talking about RICO charges because I had led this group of men to commit, you know, fraudulent activity on the ground in Afghanistan. And it was just unreal. I mean, at that point, you know, by 2019 had come in, I was in charge of a program called the Intelligence Surveillance and Reconnaissance Program. I was getting drones into places all around the world. And I was pretty livid. I was pretty furious. But then they came and they said, listen, we're going to come after your wife as well unless you cop a plea. And I talked to my attorney at the time, Augustus Invictus, who is pretty well known in amongst white national circles. I went to him, I told him what they had said, what had gone on. And he said, listen, here's what's going to happen. They're going to arrest both of you. They're going to arrest both of you while you're at work. That way you lose your jobs. You'll both go to jail. You'll both have to bail yourselves out of jail. You will both have to get your own attorneys. Your attorneys will begin to argue that one or the other should begin to work against the other defendant. It will begin to rip apart your marriage. It will cost tens of thousands of dollars to defend. They know that you've had the money in the past. You have some money now. They're going to come after you in every which way possible. And they're going to come after her. And they're going to try to make it painful. And you may win, but it will be a Pyrrhic victory, and it's unlikely that your marriage will survive such a brutal fight because the attorneys will be involved and they will be looking at the best interests of their respective clients, which unfortunately would be each of you. And you know, I have to talk to them about it. I was like, listen, you know, we got kids. We have seven kids. I love my wife. You know, I didn't want to have us lose everything. And so I said, go get us the best plea you can get. And he did, and I wound up pleading guilty to four charges of false statements to the government. No financial losses were accumulated. They said there was a ton of financial losses from the guys eating on base, but I mean, that was ridiculous. It's so much so that even the judge gave me a $400 fine. That was the total fine that she gave me was $400. And they wanted to give me though the maximum sentence they possibly could. Now, at the time when I pled guilty to say that I was going to go in for probation, and a black, I guess when he's kind of an advisor to the judge, there's a certain points system that's available. So this point system was raised that it wound up giving me additional points because I had used electronic means. Well, it happened to have coincided at the same time that the SPLC had doxxed Identity Dixie, a group with which I'm involved. And Identity Dixie, I was right there in the SPLC article. It was sent over to the black advisor to the judge. The judge herself was aware of the docs, part of my sentencing. So they gave me the maximum sentence they could possibly give me based on the points. I had no previous record. And that was, I wound up getting 6 months in prison. I had to do an additional 4 months of house arrest and then 3.5 years of probation, which was the absolute cap that they can give me. But again, the financial penalty was only $400 because there was no quantifiable loss to the government. And I took the plea to save my wife, really save my wife, save my kids, you know, any kind of additional pain. And I went inside. I went into Jessup Federal Corrections Institute and turned myself in.
Jeez, what a freaking nightmare, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know what, though? It could be a nightmare, but, you know, as I talk about in the book, The Honorable Cause, I worked. Yeah, I used the time as I would have used it when I went to school or anything else. I remained very disciplined, probably the most disciplined prisoner you've ever seen. I'd get up at 5 a.m. every day. I would go to the chapel every day. I'd read my Bible every day. Once it got light out, you can go on to the yard. I would go to the yard. I would work out for 2 hours straight, come back in. I would read a book every single day. And I asked all of my supporters, I had many of them at the time who really supported me, who I asked them to send me every book they possibly could find on revolutions, counter-revolutions, revolutionary strategies, and also any books on nationalism, nationalist causes. And it didn't matter to me whether it was a Marxist revolutionary book or if it was an Irish nationalist book or if it was a book even on black nationalism. I read everything I could get my hands on throughout my time in prison to ensure. And every single day I would finish one book on nationalism of some kind. Sometimes it took me a couple of days to read if they're a little bit thicker. And I used it to study everything I possibly could about revolutionary movements and how nationalist movements eventually arise. I used any free time or downtime that I wasn't reading to speak to other prisoners, to talk to them, to talk to a lot of members of our own tribe, and to better understand some of the dynamics. Made a lot of friends inside as well. Guys that some guys were really, dirt bags, but some guys were actually guys that weren't too much dissimilar to me. And so I wound up using the time. I wound up practicing some Spanish. I wound up practicing some Russian. And I came out a stronger, better man in so many ways. And I used the time I came back, worked my ass off at a minimum wage job because that was required for work, really kind of a work program type thing. And after that, I wound up, there was a COVID hit. I wound up using one of the supply chain skills that I know best, which is moving air freight around the world. I used that to gain some contracts again. And I used that money to rebuild and build up new businesses that are capable of sustaining our people when they're doxxed.
Yeah, boy, that's an incredible story, man. And yeah, you talk about that in the intro of the book, your experience in prison and some of the books that you read. And you talk about how you studied all sorts of revolutionary movements throughout history, including the history of Irish nationalism and their struggle against British rule, the Iranian Revolution, and other anti-Western Islamic-inspired revolutionary movements in the Middle East. And then, of course, the various Marxist-inspired revolutions that have taken place throughout history. So I wanted to ask you, what are some of the main lessons that you've drawn, studying these movements, and how did you sort of apply that to this book and this sort of revolutionary mindset of Southern identity and sort of Southern independence?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. The most important thing, first and foremost, is you have to define yourselves as a group. And really, the worst thing that has happened to all forms of white nationalist movements, and that includes all ethno-white nationalist movements around the world, is that the left and the media have a jump on defining who they are. And that's a problem. If you are going, because very often what happens is if a nationalist movement is defined by somebody else, there are members of the movement who will join that movement largely because they are joining from what they've heard about that movement and not what the movement actually is. So that's the first step. You have to define who you are. You have to define that we're a Southern nationalist movement. What is Southern nationalism? Defining what it means to be Southern. All of that has to be part of who you are. And that, again, that includes anybody or everybody, whether they are Irish nationalists, German nationalists, Spanish nationalists, what have you. Every successful nationalist movement has always begun by defining who they are and why they have a right to be free, why they have a right to go after or achieve their objectives for national independence, whatever it may be. The second thing, of course, is that there needs to be a financial component that is both real, reasonable, and also that understands that you might have to make certain outward appearances that are necessary in order to ensure that the financial resources are available for the greater good, the bigger movement. there's a large portion of the white nationalist community that doesn't want to have anything to do with what they would see as compromise. And yet, at the same time, if you're going to win a long-term war, you need to be able to at least pretend to compromise when it's necessary to achieve certain objectives. You have to have the folks that are a little bit smarter, able to get inside the boardrooms, able to get inside the offices, able to work on those various white-collar careers, work with Jewish people or Black people or what have you, in order to ensure that you are your long-term objective of war, winning a war for your people, is achieved. And that may require a certain level of simply, you know, craft, so to speak.
Or just frankly being practical about the matter. Yeah.
Exactly right. You know, it's one of those things where what used to drive me crazy in League of the South is I would come across a lot of folks that were just really just good people, you know, good Southern folks. But every so often you get a sweet tea skinhead and they'd have 1488 tattooed to their neck and they'd have, you know, tattoos on their face and all that kind of, you know, holy blooey. And, you know, and there I am in a suit and again, a white guy who, you know, for the most part can blend into just about any boardroom there is. And, you know, you'd have these guys that said, well, you know, the Jew kept me out of work. Well, no, the 1488 neck tattoo kept you out of work, most likely. You know, you have to be realistic with regard to the environment within which you are currently operating. If you want to succeed, you've got to be, you know, you have to play the part sometimes. But remembering that you don't have to forget your principles. You certainly don't have to forget your people. You just have to be able to play the game a little bit and make sure that from a practical perspective, you're going to need to wear the boat shoes sometimes. You're going to need to shake hands with folks you don't necessarily like. You're going to have to borrow money from different institutions that you don't like. But at the end of the day, your people, the long-term objectives of your people need to be front and center in your mind at all times. And I would say that was probably the third lesson, by the way, would be just that. Anybody who's going to be – there's a lot of narcissistic personalities out there who want to claim to be the next Hitler or the next leader and whatnot. It's never about that. You really have to set aside your egos and you have to work with small groups of similarly dedicated men and women who want to achieve objectives for their people, their nation, in such a way that they may never know your name. They may never know your real name. They may never know what it is, who you are. And in 100, 150 years from now, people won't know your name unless they're your kin. But your movement will have won. And that's got to be the most important thing. The early founders of, say, the Irish Republican Brotherhood, after 16 failed armed attempts at of rebelling against the British, finally won on their 17th attempt. Well, the big difference was that from 1848 until 1916, and really 1918 when it kicked off the War of Independence in Ireland, what they did was they invested in the development of the Irish Republican Brotherhood. They invested in their own media. They invested in alternative media. They even invested in arbitration courts that bypassed the British system. So they wound up investing in their people. Nobody really knows the name of those arbitration court managers. Nobody really knows the name of those publishers or the little guy that printed paperwork. Sure, they may know an Arthur Griffith. They certainly know Michael Collins and Eamon de Valera. But they're not necessarily going to know everybody that's part of the movement. And yet they were finally able to succeed when they began doing the little things that incrementally built up the needs of their people in such a way that it caused a core Irish identity to finally achieve independence in the 17th try.
That's very interesting. So it's almost like building sort of like a parallel type society. Is that sort of what you're getting at? Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's very important. And the lessons that you sort of articulated there are totally spot on. And I can tell you definitely did use your time well studying it, you know, in prison, I guess. What else are you going to do but make the most of it, you know, given the circumstances?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, again, a lot of the folks that are in there, again, there's some nasty individuals that are inside of prison, no question about it. But I'm not a small fellow. I mean, I'm 6'3", I'm 300 pounds. I'm, you know, I can hold my own just about anywhere. You know, as a boy, I got into more fights and scraps than I could, you know, often with my younger brother, who was just as big. But, you know, it's one of those things where you present yourself as a man. You walk the yard, you walk the halls, you walk in the food line, and you read and you study and you remain respectful. You remember who your tribe is. You hang with other white men. You talk to them and you find ways in which you can begin to build bridges, because ultimately coming out, I knew I was going to become even more dedicated and more driven to destroying this Yankee empire that has kept its boot on the neck of the Southern people since 1865. Mm-hmm. And that was going to be my cause. Hey, John, you there?
Oh, geez, I'm so sorry. I had myself muted. I was saying I wanted to talk kind of just more generally about the book. And ask you just a couple, you know, sort of general questions. One, how did you come up with the idea for this book, and how did you choose the various contributors?
So, yeah, I wrote A Walk in the Park, my Charlottesville story, and published it last year. And when I published it, I thought, you know, we're now telling our story about Charlottesville, but the real goal has to be telling our story about who we are and what is Southern nationalism. And so I thought about who were the folks that are out there that really work on identifying Southern nationalism. And of course, my colleagues at Identity Dixie, many of whom wrote under various pseudonyms in the book, I asked them if they could assist me. And they said, absolutely, they would love to write an essay. A few of them wrote essays in the book. Rick Dirtwater, a very good friend of mine, he is also one of the editors at Identity Dixie. He wrote a chapter and also helped me edit as well. So he's my co-editor. Michael Hill was a natural request, because Michael Hill, whether or not I haven't always agreed with the strategic methods of League of the South, but I've always believed very strongly in the mission, and I believe in the, you know, the authenticity of the men within League of the South and how well committed they are. I think Dr. Hill is one of the most committed men to his people, and has been doing this now for 30 years. Of putting his neck out there on behalf of the South. So it was natural to ask him if he would like to contribute an essay, which he did. I asked James Edwards. I've known James. I've talked to James before, but we really began, you know, I've known about, of course, the show, The Political Cesspool. He's, you know, the mouth of the South. He's, you know, I just wanted to find out if he'd be interested in writing an essay as well. He had interviewed me for A Walk in the Park, and I came back to him and said, hey, would you be interested in doing this book? He's like, absolutely. So, you know, he wrote an essay there. Ann Wilson Smith had written a book called Charlottesville Untold, which is on the Unite the Right, where she had various interviews. It's a fantastic book, by the way, on Charlottesville, because she interviewed probably about 20 or 30 people to get a better perspective on what was happening in Charlottesville, what happened at Charlottesville, and what happened after, you know, kind of the aftermath. And so I asked her, because, you know, she had interviewed me for the book as well, and we talked. And then there's Rebecca Dillingham, a.k.a. the Dissident Mama, who has been very active. I asked her, because I wanted to get some women involved in the overall book. And one of my wife's friends is a very dedicated Southern woman. She works in television down in the Savannah area, out of the Savannah area, I should say, around Southern food. So I asked her, Dixie O'Hara, to write a chapter on, to again bridge these, sort of include both male and female perspectives on what a free South would look like. And of course, myself. I mean, I wound up writing, you know, my chapter, the introduction, and my chapter as well, sort of opening and closing the book on either side. And I, you know, really, and I, your review, by the way, was fantastic, and I really appreciate it. Yeah, it really, the way the essays came together, nobody was given a topic to talk about. They were just told, hey, go ahead and do this, and you write what you want to write. We'll include it. We'll make a flow happen out of this. And everybody seemed to just sort of click. It all kind of came together like Legos, which was great.
Yeah, yeah. And that's very, very apparent as you read the book. You know, everybody's kind of got their own unique perspective. And I think, like, you know, as I said at the beginning, it makes a very, very strong case for the Southern cause. And it's more or less, and you can kind of address this, you know, in more detail, like the purpose of the book, as I see it, it's like sort of articulating articulating the fact that the South and the Southern people form a distinct ethnic group within the United States, but making a broader case for independence for the Southern people, and, you know, establishing an independent Southern, I don't want to say necessarily Confederacy, a republic, or some sort of institution, some sort of governing institution that, you know, champions the interests of the Southern people. Is that more or less kind of like the purpose of it, to sort of articulate these ideas?
Yeah, that's correct. The, you know, there's a lot of times there are folks that are American nationalists, and I was once an American nationalist, who will tell me, well, we can't dissolve the Union. By dissolving the Union, that shows them that we won. Well, we're not going to talk many of these blue states, which are primarily in Yankee locations, we're not going to talk them into believing that all of a sudden into constitutional values and principles. They're just not going to do that. They've abandoned them. And I've talked to many of these leftists before when I was in school and elsewhere, where they have a very strong opinion that the Constitution needs to be essentially torn up and thrown away. I believe that the Constitution is a great document. It's not a perfect document. And it, unfortunately, it failed to protect us from what the modernity we are now suffering under. That's a big problem. However, that a lot of the principles that are expressed in the Constitution should survive. You know, I am a big champion of free speech. I do believe in the freedom of religion. There's good examples of that. The right to own guns, the right to have some form of due process. These are all Western concepts that do not exist anywhere else in the world, and yet they're codified in our Constitution. Well, I will ask those folks who are American nationalists who don't want to see any kind of breakup or dissolution of the Union, I'll say, you know, which is more important to you, the geographic confines of these United States or the constitutional principles upon which we created an entire republic? What's more important to you? And, you know, right now we are in a race really between a red and blue state division, very sharply divided country right now, where people are voting with their feet. You know, in my Florida has turned very, very red. There's good reasons for that. There's some real political dynamics at play that a lot of the country didn't understand. But in terms of Florida, we're watching, Florida had a net migration of 6% of blacks in the last 2 years left the state. The LGBT community, so-called LGBT community, they are leaving the state in by the thousands because of recent legislation passed at the most conservative point. One of the other elements that I thought about with regard to revolutions is one of the key elements of any revolution that is successful is you don't play by their rules. You play by your own rules, your new rules. And we needed to do something different, which we began in Florida. It's actually called the Florida Project back in 2020. That is working amongst Southern nationalists who are now using every single city council, town council, smaller groups, even little boards of education, wherever they may be found, and turning Florida extremely red, as far, far to the right as we possibly can, because we want to see a Florida that is very far to the right. We're doing this now in Georgia. We're doing this again in Alabama. We'll be working in Alabama soon. So when you look at whether or not this union can survive, I don't believe the union can survive. If people are voting with their feet, it's only going to be a matter of time before the tensions between blue and red states begin to emerge, such that either there will be a war of some kind of civil war in these United States, or one or the other will win the political fight, so to speak, in Washington, D.C., and it looks like the blue states are going to win that by virtue of sheer numbers and voting manipulation. They're able to change votes. I do not believe that Biden won in 2020. I think that's a con. And they will make sure that the votes are there to keep out anything that might even sniff of nationalism, let alone conservatism. So, you know, again, we're now in a race essentially to try to get out of this union before it tries to gobble us up.
Yeah, absolutely. And in your intro, you basically talk about how right now we're facing an ideal opportunity to sort of spread this message of nationalism and, you know, maybe Southern nationalism in particular. And ultimately, you know, sort of coming up with an alternative political solution rather than maintaining this multiracial empire. That's essentially what the United States has morphed into, really, for, you know, generations now, but that's certainly on display now. I wanted to actually read just briefly from page 7. This is in your intro. You say here, the beauty of the current environment is that the United States government is making every classic mistake of a country about to implode. The study of any successful revolution clearly points this out. The expansion of the police state, the exploitation of media mechanisms to suppress unflattering or contradictory information, the overreaction to dissent, and the targeting of the popular genetic majority through weaponizing minority grievances has always led to a country's collapse. The only thing we lack as a true revolutionary movement is a complete collapse in democratic trust. As long as Americans trusted that their vote mattered, we had an uphill battle. It is hard to get even an enraged citizenry to embrace change when they believe they can vote their way out of an unacceptable political situation. Thankfully, the U.S. government decimated that trust. And I think that we are definitely heading in that direction if we're not there already. I mean, with everything that's happened with Trump and the 2020 election and the whole COVID scam, there is absolutely no faith or trust in any of these institutions, at least by a sizable, you know, majority of the population at this point. Certainly, you know, the more conservative right-wing faction of the American populace, which I think is growing with each and every day. And that's as you articulate there in the introduction, that's the direction the country's headed in.
That's right. If you look at recent polls, in early 2021, 66% of Republicans in the South wanted to embrace secession. 34% of these United States embraced some form of secession, a two-state divide, essentially. Now, that was in early 2021, so that's shortly after the 2020 election. I think the 2022 election was really a microcosm of a much broader and bigger issue with this democracy that we are currently facing here in the United States, and being that whether or not there's outright cheating, Dominion voting machines, and all that kind of stuff, you know, I think that some shenanigans occurred. There's no question that some shenanigans occurred, in my opinion, places like Fulton County, Georgia. But that said, I think the bigger issue is that, and this is something that I think some of the older white folks who didn't want to be racist are beginning to identify, is that all you need to do to win an election is bring a bunch of ballots and a fold-out table in front of a black church on a Sunday. And you can ballot harvest at your heart's, to your heart's desire in a place like Pennsylvania or Michigan, whether it's in Philadelphia or Detroit. So now you don't have to have black folks have to do much more than walk out of church or maybe walk out of this door. You put them in a corner. Say, hey, I'm taking your ballots, taking your votes. You know, there's a corner on, you know, one of those crummy streets they've got in Detroit or Chicago, south side of Chicago, wherever it may be. And with that ability to do so, you're negating the votes of whites who are much more dispersed or geographically in areas that are a little harder for us to find some kind of natural congregation point. You can, I guess, go into suburbs. You can maybe do well there. Well, you get the exurbs and the rural areas, you know, to find every church here in the South, there's a church in almost every mile, if not more so, you know, where churches are serving the rural communities and there's various congregations, you would literally run yourself rampant just trying to collect those votes. So you can now have an environment where minorities that are concentrated in urban environments can easily overwhelm the democratic process simply by ballot harvesting. That's number one. So when you have a group of people in 2022 who believed strongly that Carrie Lake would win, they believed that there was a chance in Pennsylvania for Oz, Mehmet Oz, to win, that they thought that there would be a number of Trump-supported candidates that would win, I don't think they ever really considered the fact that the opposition party, A, does not want any of these Trump candidates to win and will fight everything they can against them. And it doesn't really matter if it's Trump or anybody else. Trump is simply just a symbol, so to speak, for the overall disaffected white majority, which is quickly becoming a plurality. The bigger challenge winds up being for those who are, again, if they're voting, their vote didn't work in 2020. They know that the election was stolen, and then they look at 2022, and they say they believe the election was stolen in several states, including Arizona. In Georgia as well. When you look at Georgia, the Walker election, now that was a ridiculous election. I don't know why they chose a black man who sounds like he's chewing on marbles to be the Senate candidate, but that's not beside the point.
Right.
You know, you look at this in the totality. Now that's two elections in a row where people feel like they have had their vote stolen. And so if in early 2021, 66% of Republicans in the South supported secession, 34% around the United States in general, supports secession, 34% of the overall population, that is. Republican or Democrat. Can you imagine what it must be now today?
Right.
I would believe it's probably in excess of 50%. If it was 34% in the beginning of 2021, it's probably close to 50% now. Believe that at a minimum, a two-state solution, red and blue states, is the only way in which we walk away from this peacefully.
Mm-hmm. Well, I follow Rasmussen public polling pretty closely. I get their email updates pretty much every single day. And I even cited one in the review that I wrote. The most recent one that I've seen anyways was from earlier this year. I think it was in late February, where 34% overall of you know, likely voters in America favored the concept of a quote-unquote national divorce, which is something that, you know, even, you know, popular Republican, you know, congressmen like Marjorie Taylor Greene, for example, has publicly talked about and, you know, advocated for. You know, I got a tweet, you know, published right in this review talking about from, you know, directly from Marjorie Taylor Greene, openly arguing, you know, and advocating for a national divorce along ideological lines between red states and blue states. And, you know, it's just becoming increasingly more and more clear, you know, how dysfunctional the country has become, how illegitimate the federal government certainly and the mass media has become, how completely weaponized the entire system has become against conservatives, against, you know, Trump supporters, against Trump himself, and probably even more importantly, just generally against white people. I mean, there's been a war on white Americans for a very, very long time, you know, through the immigration policies, through economic policies, through, you know, policies like affirmative action, for example, and these diversity quotas and just this whole concept of diversity and multiculturalism. These are all very anti-white policies that are designed to fundamentally change the country, to transform the country. You know, we see how our history has been weaponized. That's why I think, like, you know, publications like the Barnes Review are so important, because our historical narrative has been totally weaponized against white people, against Southerners, you know, against white people more generally. And, you know, that again, that's sort of the direction the country's headed. And more just of your normies are recognizing this. You know, they're becoming more and more radicalized, and frankly, for good reason.
Listen, I 100% agree with you. You know, and this is where, if you think about this now, this war on whites it's even deeper. The zeitgeist of white people has been one in which they have transformed from a group that once conquered to one that is now foolishly plodding along with anything that is given to them. And that's a form of conditioning that is really has been devastating white people in general. Now, you look at television as a good example. For the better part of the last 50 years, give or take, white men, they do not depict strong white men who have some level of intelligence. When they do, they're often a bad guy. That's how they depict white men. Oh, more normally, the white dad is a buffoon. He's a chubby, affable buffoon, but he's a buffoon. And you contrast that against the depictions of black men, the wiser black male, strong in his ways and his moral character and what have you. And, well, white people would start believing that, especially whites that have never really interacted with blacks before. Which is a good hunk of the country, by the way, that don't even have any blacks near them. So when you have years and years of watching movies like, say, Shawshank Redemption, where Morgan Freeman is this noble black man, strong in his ways and wisdom and what have you, and nice guy who tries to help a white guy out who was being raped inside the prison system. Or you look at, again, guys like Married with Children, you know, the Al Bundy types of depictions, or even the Family Guy or something of that nature, where Peter is this like chubby white guy in the Midwest. The constant drumbeat that has denigrated white males at the same time of elevating black males and other minorities. And even worse, of course, has been what? The depictions of white women, attractive white women, who gravitate towards black men or other types of minorities on television and through film and what have you. There has been a constant war, a social war, on white identity easily for the last 50 years. And it has now come to a point where I think it's sort of, I think I kind of crossed the Rubicon a few years ago. I could see it now. You see these normies, especially probably around 2000. I mean, I myself saw this. I was complaining about this back then. Can I please get a commercial that doesn't have a multiracial couple, you know, on television back in 2010? This is before I was involved in any kind of movement. And yet I was complaining about it. And so are the folks. Well, now it's really beginning to hit a high watermark, I think, where you are beginning to see more and more whites say, wait a second, we are being wiped off the face of the earth from advertising, normal white people, at least. I mean, I guess if you're a transvestite, you can get on there. You can get yourself a beer can. But if you're a regular white person, you are no longer an invited member of a country or a society, Western civilization, that your people built.
Yeah, absolutely. Very, very well said. I'll tell you what, we've only got about 10 more minutes left, and there were some other sort of like more broader questions that the book kind of addresses that I'd like for you to respond to. And one is like, explain the concept of like Southern identity. What does it mean to be Southern? Like, how would you sort of, you know, describe it to an average person? Like, what makes the Southern people a distinct ethnic group in the broader United States?
The South is an area that, as a result of a number of factors, both culturally influenced and genetic influences, has become its own unique identity in its own right within the region. We have our own foods, we have our own traditions, we have our own history. That history was largely defined by a war between the states from 1861 to 1865. Even though the South was taking root as distinct colonies and then distinct early states with very different sets of views than their northern neighbors, the South is an area that is unique, and it's clearly unique if you just speak to folks. We have our own linguistic tempo, we have our own words, our own phrases, again, our own foods. So if you look at the South, by any definition of an ethnic group, it will tell you that an ethnic group is a group that has emerged with its own cultures, traditions, values, and history. And that is very clearly the South and Southern people. You know, you can look at the Irish and the English and say, well, they look a heck of a lot alike, and they do look a lot alike. You look at the Irish and the Scots and say they're both a lot alike. But they're very different people. Why? Because they have very different histories, even though they've interacted quite a bit with one another. They have different histories, different traditions, different values. Some of the values intersect. Some of the values are the same. Some are different. They have emerged as distinct ethnicities. The Germans and the Austrians are two distinct ethnicities. One is as largely defined by its proximity to Italy, the Alps, and so forth. The other is largely defined by its central position within Europe. They speak the same language. They have very similar foods. They have very similar historic backgrounds. But of course, Austria had been a unified country previously an empire for centuries, whereas Germany is a relatively new creation as a German state that is a holistic German state. Within Germany, you have Bavaria, Prussia, etc. Again, unique distinctions within Germany, but these are Germans who have chosen to enter into a voluntary union of states in the mid-19th century to create Germany. The South chose to voluntarily enter into a union, not unlike the European Union, where the states wound up subordinating themselves to a federal architecture that became these United States. We have a legal right to leave these United States. Just like I don't think any sane country would support the suppression of England because it chose Brexit. You know, I don't see where France or Germany would use its weapons of war to go out and force England back into the European Union. So too should the South be allowed to leave this union of states when it no longer fits our needs as a people through a democratic process. But again, we have our own history. We have our own culture. We have our own traditions. We have our own values. Even from a faith-based perspective, we're amongst the most densely Christian region in these United States by far. We vote at the most conservative levels by far. So it's clear that we are different than the rest of the country. And that is the definition of an ethnicity, and that is why the South is very distinctly its own people.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's pretty obvious to anybody that's just, you know, I myself am not from the South, but you know, you go down to the South to travel or whatever, and it's very clear you're in it's almost like you're in a different country. You know, the language, the accent, yeah, everything. It's very distinct and very, very unique. And I think you're absolutely right. One last question before we wrap up. The ultimate, and then this is a very sort of bold, some would even say controversial, ultimate goal for the Southern people, and that is secession and the formation of an independent, you know, Southern Republic. And I think one of the issues is that word secession is so sort of tied up, you know, in common people's understanding with violence or with conflict. So I guess what could you articulate, like, what is the ultimate goal that you guys advocate in the book? I know it is secession. And does that necessarily entail violence or conflict, or can this be done peacefully?
I think it would be done peacefully. You know, we've had secessions that have occurred that have been done peacefully. Czechoslovakia is now the Czech Republic, and Slovakia. That was a secession that occurred, and nobody fired a single shot at one another. Scotland just recently seceded from within the United Kingdom. It chose to secede. Now you have other areas of the world that on occasion do secede. Now sometimes the aggressor, the larger party, decides that it will not allow secession to occur. And in those cases, they will use their violence essentially to try to impose their will on these smaller groups that are trying to walk away from a larger group. And that does happen, unfortunately. But for us, on our side, as a smaller party, as a party that considers itself to have its own distinct identity and wants to carve out its own future by virtue of its own nation state, the Southern people don't want to have violence. We don't want to go to war with these United States. We would like to be a peacefully seceded group. And I think that can occur. I think eventually that may ultimately happen. I think there will be a number of blue states who get fed up with the fact that they are being checked by red state politicians, essentially. And there will be red staters, especially because things are moving to the right in ways that I don't even think the Republican Party or members of the right really can truly comprehend. They're beginning to get it. I mean, you get like the Marjorie Taylor Greene, who I'm not a huge fan of, but every so often she hits things on the head. I think when you look at the Ted Cruz's of the world, who were considered conservatives in 2015, 2016, now they're defending positions like the right to gay rape in Uganda, weird stuff like that. I don't see that the red America is tolerating anymore what has been shoved down their throats in these sort of compromises of their values. And that's what the Paul Ryans of the world, they don't get that. They just simply don't understand that. And so it's only a matter of time, but it will happen where these red state type conservatives who do eventually get elected into positions of authority begin acting on behalf of their constituents just for sheer self-serving purposes. You know, they want to be reelected. And when they do that, they're going to become a problem, a thorn in the side of a blue state consortium that has always felt that it can kind of get away with anything they wanted because they were always pushing the envelope and pushing the Overton window further and further to the left. Well, when you have folks push back to the right, you get chaos. I mean, again, you look at Florida as a great example of that. In Florida, we have a functioning voting system, but we also have a functioning voting system because DeSantis and his team took steps that were, for the most part, pretty cutthroat. They were the kind of things that blue staters do to ensure their power in perpetuity. Well, he did the same in Florida, and Florida will never have a Democrat governor again. It just won't happen. And I'm not, that's not me being a, not being overly optimistic. That's just a fact. Well, I think as this begins to happen and then they begin to get checked, I think what you'll find is a desire to force out those red states, get them out of here. And I think there'll be red staters who will want to leave. And so
that is an interesting perspective. So you actually think it'll be the more liberal blue states that will want to end the union rather than the other way around?
Yes.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. Well, and I mean, you know, on a practical level, I guess, how would that come about? Would it be at the state legislature level? Like each state would have to, I mean, cause that's originally how the South seceded, right? I mean, the state legislatures voted to leave the union, right?
That's right. that's what would have to happen. So you'd have to have a situation in which the blue state legislatures decided that, well, there's two ways in which it could happen. One is the blue states could say, you either accept this position or not. Let's say Biden wins election. I think whoever the Democratic candidate is in 2024 will win the election. That's my guess here. And I think there's going to be a lot of disappointed conservatives in the Wednesday, the first Wednesday in November of 2024. And so if you get this blue stater, again, whether it's Biden or it's Newsom or whomever, that is in the presidency and begins to push things further and further to the left, you will have red states that will say, this is not working out anymore. We want to get out of here. I think you'll have, but they will do everything they possibly can to make trouble for whomever that blue stater is at the head of the executive branch and the head of the government. Now, while that's happening at the same time, I would not be surprised if blue staters told red staters, get out of here. In fact, you're beginning to see a little bit of this with the Greater Idaho movement. The Greater Idaho movement, for those not aware, I think it's, if I'm not mistaken, it's really mostly affecting Washington State, where a number of counties that are largely underpopulated but have large swaths of territory in Washington want to leave and join Idaho. There are arguments right now from those within the left, within those circles, who are saying, if we can get rid of them, we can finally achieve the utopia we've always wanted to in the state of Washington. And so let's let them go. And I think that's probably what would happen. You'd have red staters complaining about the blue stater power. You would have blue states that would say, get rid of them. They keep stopping us from achieving a utopia, which has been the goal of the left forever. That's really what leftism is all about, is achieving a human utopia. And I think their state secessions would begin. They would have state secession conventions at about the same time the red state secession conventions began. And you probably have some kind of little sort of an agreement, say, hey, we'll come into a collective defense. We'll go into a commerce clause, but you have your president. We have our president. You have your laws. We have our laws. You have your Supreme Court. We'll have our own Supreme Court or something along those lines. And you will have a two-state solution that eventually emerges that winds up having a blue America, United States of America, and a red United States of America.
Very, very interesting. Yeah, no, a lot to think about for sure. And again, you know, the book makes a very, very strong case, and I think the winds are sort of blowing in that direction, and it's becoming increasingly clear that this entire setup here in the United States is just not benefiting anybody but the plutocrats and the oligarchs at the very, very top running everything. Absolutely. So the book is definitely worth reading, certainly if you're interested in Southern history, Southern identity, the Southern cause in general. I would highly recommend checking it out. It is available from the Barnes Review. It is also available from Amazon. And Patrick, I meant to ask you actually at the beginning of the program. I know I follow Identity Dixie. It's identitydixie.com. Is that the best probably like website that you would recommend, or do you have your own personal website? I'm not even sure.
Yeah, so there's identitydixie.com. You know, we certainly can follow me there, follow my colleagues. I got some great guys on the team that really work hard. We're all volunteers. We all volunteer writers. I do have Dixie on the Rocks as well. It's a podcast every week. I'm sort of wax on all kinds of different topics, whatever it may be, often coinciding with Identity Dixie's written work. So Dixie on the Rocks is available. You can find Dixie on the Rocks on Spotify and a few other venues as well. And then on Gab, you know, Patrick Martin on Gab. I mean, I love hearing from different folks, even whether they want to say, you know, you're a butt, whatever, or you're great, whatever it may be. Of course, I prefer to be respectful, and I prefer if you have any kind of issues with anything I've said, please, I mean, write me on the side and DM me and say, hey, you know, Patrick, I heard you say this or that, and I don't agree, or, hey, you know, I love what you had to say one way or the other. I've made a lot of really good friends. I myself I'm still politically active, in fact, a little more politically active than I was in the past, because now my companies are doing quite well. So at least some of the brokerage side of it is doing very, very well. And so I just recently spoke at Dixie Republic, along with James, by the way. I was on James's show this last weekend on the political cesspool, but I was at Dixie Republic giving a speech on behalf of Southern secession and what Southern white people need to do to take it a step forward and really achieve secession. And I've been just meeting with folks, and we've become very politically active. So, yeah, please write me a gab, say, hey, how can I become involved? How can I get involved in the Southern cause and really advance the work for my people?
Very good, man. I just found you on Gab. I just followed you, so I'll have a link over to that.
Great.
When I post this podcast program, and I'll have links to your podcast, Dixie on the Rocks. I just found that as well, and also your author page over at identitydixie.com. So thanks a lot, man. I appreciate it. I know you're a busy man. I do have your book, actually. I bought A Walk in the Park, you know, the book about Charlottesville. I did purchase that as well. Yeah, I'd like to maybe do an interview about that in the future. That's a whole other can of worms, a whole topic that we could talk for hours about, I'm sure.
Yeah, the United Right, the anniversary is coming up in a couple of weeks. So, yeah, by all means, I would love to have this conversation again with you, John. I really do appreciate the opportunity.
Okay, thank you, sir. I appreciate it. You take care, and I'll be in touch.
You have a great night. Thank you very much, and God bless.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.